What up? It's Young Soul, Soulcast, Holiday Edition. Got my man Chesky Ramos from Fake 4 Inc. in this motherfucker. Actually, not in the motherfucker, but on Skype. Yeah, so today we're going to be talking with Chesky Ramos. Chesky is a rapper slash songwriter. His influences range everywhere from like freestyle fellowship, kind of West Coast stuff, to the newer folk punky kind of stuff. He's doing super original shit right now. Amazing performer. Just a good fucking dude who knows what the fuck he's talking about. And he's done a lot of good shit for a lot of people, myself included. Chesky Ramos, what up, man? How you living?
Large, man. Just living hella large. I'm doing well, man. Just finished some music projects and ready for the new year.
Yep. What, you just finished your new album?
Yeah. It's called Broken Bone Ballads, and it's with Factor produced it, and I'm excited about that. And I'm also finishing up the split 12-inch with Pat the Bunny right now as well. So,
are there collaborative songs with Pat on there, or is it just like side by side?
There's two collaborative songs.
Fuck yeah!
But they're all acoustic, and we have like my friend Adam Matlock played accordion, and we have a bunch of friends playing instruments, like. Oh, a bunch of my friends from out here in New Haven. Violin, accordion, banjo, stuff like that. It's pretty cool.
So it has like a kind of solid aesthetic across both sides, like it's consistent.
Exactly. Oh. Yeah. I remember talking to Pat about it. He's like, yeah, that's on you, man, whatever. Because I had this whole like aesthetic. I wanted to keep some sort of continuity between both sides, you know.
That's awesome. That's really smart. Yeah, I was wondering.
Even artistically, you know, even like the artwork and everything on the albums, it's going to be like, it's going to feel like an album, you know.
All right, well, let's just get into it, man. First question, you just got out of jail a year ago. You've been free for almost exactly a year now.
Yes.
You were arrested for drug shit, but you went to prison. So, I don't know, what was prison like, man?
Well, when I went in originally, I went to the New Haven County Jail for about a month, and that was a level 4/5 facility where a lot of people were awaiting trial. You know, there were people on trial for murder, for violent charges or whatever. It was all kind of mixed in. There were junkies detoxing right there, vomiting everywhere. It was intense. Yeah, it was just like this. You know, they had us sleeping on floors. There were so many people in the New Haven County. And about a month after, I got transferred to a level 2 facility in Niantic, Connecticut, where it was almost all drug charges, nonviolent criminals, almost all drug dealers and some addicts. But It changed a lot there. I mean, it's pretty similar. Like, they put us in these huge spaces, probably that they fit about 120 dudes in these spaces with bunks, and they split it up into little cubes. You spend a lot of time with your cube mates in there, and you know, share bathroom space, share, you know, go to the cafeterias a certain time, go out at certain times. Everything is, of course, really regimented. And it's a shitty way to live, but you get used to it. I feel like human beings get used to anything if they're forced into it long enough. It's, you know.
One of the things I thought was really interesting was you feeling guilty for all the mail you were receiving.
Yeah.
Know, like feeling like you were like some privileged shit or something. Can you talk about that?
As I'm staring at two letters from friends from jail, I definitely need to write to some of my friends from jail right now. Being an artist and having the support of fans and stuff, I ended up getting hundreds and hundreds of letters, probably close to 100 books sent to me as well. maybe hundreds. They eventually cut me off on the books. They didn't want to. The CEOs didn't want to bring me any more books. But but every time there'd be mail, I would be getting these stacks of letters, and I'd be immediately surrounded by seven other dudes who usually didn't get anything and had been in jail for years at this point, and sort of didn't have great family relationships usually, were kind of coming out to nothing when they did come out. We were in a level two facility, so everybody was sort of at the end of their if they had really long stints, they were at the end of their stays. Like they probably have a year or two left at that point, or months left in some cases. But they didn't have anything to come out to. And I did feel guilty to an extent because I was getting a lot of attention. I don't know, mainly fans and supporters writing to me. And just seeing the people around me who didn't have that, it was disheartening. I mean, to an extent, I also felt like singled out. The COs would always, you know, make some sort of comment about like Julio Ramos, look who has mail again, you know, like, you know,
oh god,
assholes. And eventually I actually started sharing letters with some of the friends I made in there. They just wanted to read some of the stuff I was getting, and I would share books with them. It became sort of like our cube became kind of like a little makeshift library.
That's awesome.
And I would even share letters. I mean, because some of these people who wrote to me, I didn't know them. They'd even write me anonymous letters, and I'd be like, I'd sort of just pass it around for to give people stuff to read.
That's cool.
You definitely make friends in there. When you're stuck in a space for long enough, you definitely make good friends that, you know, you get to know each other pretty well on a different kind of level. A lot of, you know, obviously had to joke around. I played a lot of chess in there, read a lot, worked out, was, you know, doing my push-ups and stuff like that. I had a guy, this dude Rasheen Shelby, was a really good guy. He's still locked up right now. He sort of took me under his wing and was just like, "All right, now you're gonna have to start working out because it's that time of day where the whole cube works out." Or, you know, we had our little rules for the cube, which was this week you have to sweep and mop in the cube, or, you know, we made up our own little rules within this space. So that was interesting as well.
But you were talking about, like, you know, the race stuff, and how, like, you know, whites stuck with whites. And can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I feel like it's a bit different in Connecticut. One of the interesting things that I noticed going into Niantic specifically, because when I was in the county, it's sort of everybody's kind of thrown in there and living on top of each other, it feels like. So there weren't splits like that as much. When I got to Niantic, the actual COs, the correctional officers, would split people by race. And cubes, which are groups of bunks, would be split. All right, you put two Hispanics there, two blacks there, two white. Like, they would split people by race. It's really crazy, and they were very obvious about it. It wasn't anything hidden. And people did stick together. There weren't – I noticed, especially with the white people, there were a group of white guys there, and I would regularly see about 100 people every day in the yard or whatever, and it tended to be white addicts that were in there, and maybe they were in there for other reasons as well, but they seemed to be, they'd always like stick together and kind of like walk around the I don't know, the yard together and kind of not mingle with anybody else. Puerto Rican gangs, sort of like Latin Kings and Nieta, gangs like that, they sort of seem to have the most cultural influence over things in a lot of ways. Like, all the cooking that we would do in jail was based around what we could get on commissary. So, ramen noodles, ramen is like the base of all cooking in prison. And in Connecticut prisons, I don't know how it is outside of here, but in Connecticut prison, they would make something called mofongo, traditional Puerto Rican dish made out of plantains. And, you know, my father being from Puerto Rico, I've been eating mofongo my whole life, and I get to prison and they're calling this ramen dish with rice, and it's kind of like they almost make their own dough out of chips and ramen and then put it on a bed of rice with adobo seasoning, and they call it mofongo. And that was one example of how Puerto Rican culture had sort of taken over Connecticut jail culture. But quite honestly, I think Connecticut prisons were pretty diverse, and people of all races actually communicated on a daily basis. Certain people would take over certain jobs. Kitchen jobs were mainly run by the Puerto Rican inmates. The commissary handout were janitorial kind of jobs within the prisons were sort of run by the black inmates, stuff like that. But everybody sort of was forced to interact.
So it wasn't scary. Or was it scary? I mean, I don't know. Was it scary?
I mean, I wasn't scared of it, but at all. But I've heard stories from other prisoners who have been in, you know, Chicago prisons and stuff. And out there, it's just, or California prisons, out there it's way more segregated. Like, you're forced to be with, you know, with the Mexican gangs, or it's gang segregated, you know, which they still do in Connecticut to an extent. But I know for a fact that places like Chicago, California are a lot more intense with that.
Fuck, man. It's still crazy that happened to you. It's insane. You know, you're used to it now, but
yeah, I'm definitely used to it. And seeing some friends of mine going through it right now, they're going through the process of court and are probably facing jail time. It affects me in a different way. Like, I definitely feel for them. That process, the 3 years I waited before even going into prison, that affected me a lot. That was very stressful.
Yeah, I remember you. It was almost like a relief. Not really, but like, okay, it's over. At least I can just swallow my breath and get through this.
Yeah. Yep.
Fuck, man.
And it turned out a lot better than I expected, quite honestly.
Yeah, shit, man. You lost a lot of weight, came out, meditated. Do you still meditate?
The world has caught up with me a little bit, and I'm not like super on point with that right now, but I'm still working out. I had a surgery recently, so it kind of halted that for a bit. But I'm working out, eating better, and at least thinking about those things a little more, you know.
All right, well, let's change it up a little bit. Let's go to Brett. I don't know if this is this is going to be lighter conversation. So you started Fake Four Inc. You and your brother started Fake Four. You know, definitely one of the greatest record labels of our time. Why did you guys start a label at that point in time when it just seemed like almost suicidal to do something like that?
Well, we were in a band. My brother and I were in a band called Toca, and we had been signed by Snoop Dogg's management team, And we had gone through this, all this LA bullshit of just promises. And, you know, I remember they were like courting us as a label, and they brought us to like a nightclub where Eminem was, and we had like a private bartender, and there was like a private dancer for us, and it was like some Hollywood shit. And eventually the relationship with that label broke up the band, because they had they really wanted a lot of control, and I felt like they were doing things wrong, and that influenced me to want to start my own thing. I just felt like I need to release my own music somehow. I need to release music somehow, and this will be, at least I'll have, do it my way, you know? So that's why it happened when it did. And at the same time, we got help from other labels, Squid's Eye Records in Ohio and Grim Image in California, put up some money and distribution and manufacturing costs and outlets for us to do the first few records with Fake Four. So that's why it happened when it did. And then we continued it just because I'm an idiot, probably.
You know, you found all these OGs who were struggling. You did it because someone had to do it. Someone needed to fucking step up and defend this art. But what's so cool is to see it, like, it has such a rich and supportive fan base now.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah, no, there was a point where I would see that happening. And then you know, just underground hip hop that really inspired me. People like you or Mike and Nine weren't really, I mean, your position was a little bit different, obviously. You were going through the whole Anticon breakup and stuff like that at the time. But I just noticed that people didn't have the outlets. And once I got the opportunity to have distribution and have some funding, I just felt like I have to give back to the people who inspired me to do this shit in the first place, you know what I mean? And show younger audiences, hopefully younger audiences, that it still exists and it can still be relevant. And yeah, it became a bigger art project, you know what I mean? That's how I look at it.
In this time period, you know, where things are so fleeting, you know, if I feel like sometimes when I'm looking at like culture and like scenes and stuff that's happening, I feel so, I don't know if it's my age, but I just feel so like detached from everything, you know, yeah. Like whether it's blogs or what people like or whatever, particularly in a time where everything is so fleeting and so temporary. And how has that affected the way you guys are working? You know, like what, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like we've definitely, you know, the entire label is a reaction to that to an extent. You know, we've tried to sort of use some of those outlets, those traditional indie industry kind of outlets to promote our music and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, we're not deciding what we release on. It's not based on trends at all or what's going to make us instant money or anything. It's kind of, you know, we have an older idea of what a record label is, what the type of music that we put out is. It's more about an aesthetic choice than anything else, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Instead of just, you know, some trend that is hitting really hard right now or whatever. I don't know. I understand that idea of, and also the idea of community has always been something I've been all about. Even though it's really difficult to sort of create community within hip hop, I feel particularly difficult in hip hop. I was constantly sort of fighting to build it. I've been trying to sort of unite artists and release music by artists that I thought shared aesthetic value and, you know, came from similar backgrounds as far as influences. Yeah, it wasn't. It was never trend based, and it was never really smart financially.
Well. So here's the thing. So you say you had to fight to build community, and I think that's a really interesting choice of words. I know personally, being on Fake Four, I felt more supported and more community than arguably I had ever felt.
Really.
And the irony of that is that. Is that it's not a collective, you know, it's just basically like a movement that Fake Four or you are kind of curating. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Everyone is so cliquish and territorial, and there is no culture of, like, you know, support in fucking indie hip hop. It's, you know, to me, that's like why it failed to me. That's what.
I agree. I think hip hop is unique because it's built out of mainly solo acts. You know what I mean? Like, the entire genre is dominated by solo acts. So it's a lot of people sort of looking out for themselves and trying to just survive out in a brutal market, especially right now. That's how it feels, you know, over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years almost.
But I mean, it's not like that's changed. You know what I'm saying? Like, when there was hella money in selling records back in the turn of the century, you didn't have people wanting to form communes. It was still every man for himself.
Yeah, I mean, I think there has always been this odd competitive nature, this idea of competition within hip hop, even if we don't like that. That's, you know, that exists. And I think it comes back to the same thing, that it's a bunch of individuals making music and not really collaborating all that much. It's funny because we do see a lot of sort of like collabs with rappers, but it doesn't necessarily lead to true community.
Right.
It's weird. But yeah, I mean, you know, I grew up in the hardcore scene, punk scene, whatever, seeing what was happening with that and hip hop, it felt very different. Like, you go to a hardcore scene, bands would be, or you go to a hardcore show in the mid 90s, for instance, there would be activists there with booths, you know, talking about usually back then, animal rights activists and stuff like that. People would be handing flyers to the lead singer of the headlining band. They would be reading about all the local shows during their sets. There just seemed to be a lot more community there. And I never really saw that within indie hip hop, even though I thought there was, you know, there's a lot of amazing music that was coming out. Just if there are little cliques here and there that formed. But, you know, obviously Anticon's a good example of maybe one of the closest examples of what a collective, you know what I mean? Probably right. Probably one of the truest examples of it within indie hip hop ever.
Strikes me when I'm like at these DIY venues, you know, it's like the reason why you have a fourth generation of like young punk kids is because there's like a tie-in, like a cultural relevance in the community, and people built institutions, and people continue to build these institutions that that grow and last, you know?
Yes.
And we never did that in the United States. Like, no one, there were no hip hop squats. And it seems to me that, like, you know, when you hit a squat in Europe, you know, you could be playing, you know, Sol and Chesky could be playing one night, Godspeed could be playing the next night, and like you have like multi-genre venues. And I just, it's like, I don't know what it is with identities in the States where, like, you know, where there's like things are so regimented and split up, like we're so divided by scenes and music
and generations also, like, yeah, like the same kind of music can change for with the next generation, you know. It could be essentially the same type of thing, but these young kids might not respect, you know, an artist that came out 10 years earlier or 2 years earlier. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, 2 years is like 10 years now.
Yeah, it's with, really wild.
With the fucking internet.
I see a little bit of that in Minneapolis. It's probably like one of the, obviously, the history that Rhymesayers, you know, has there has affected that city a lot. And I do see things like hip hop houses that come up, and they're all kids that are into indie hip hop and put on these house shows and stuff like that. It's like about the closest I've ever seen to that in the US, and there is this sort of respect for their elders there that I don't really see too often. I see a little bit in LA as well, but yeah, it's, you know, splintered.
So like when I think about songs like No New York and the One Man Band breakup, like sometimes I think I'm like, oh shit, he's rapping about me. You know, he's rapping about people like me, you know, like these old OGs that are just like out in the world and just like, fuck, you know? But yet you still like knowing what was ahead of you, potentially, you still like pursued this path of releasing music, like knowing like the futility of it all. Why do you still pursue a music career?
Oh, there's nothing makes me feel better than making music and performing. It's just, I don't know, and reaching people. I know it's not a good idea for a career. I understand it. I've seen many people fail before me. And to an extent, I've obviously romanticized self-saboteurs, and I am one myself to an extent. And that doesn't matter to me that much. It's just the fact that we get to make music and share it with people is just so powerful to me still.
Yeah.
So many years later, after doing it for so fucking long already, it still has that power. I don't know.
Yeah, sometimes I feel the same way. I mean, I do feel the same way, obviously, but I just wonder, I don't know what else. I mean, certainly in these precarious times, nothing is a sure shot, so you got to do what you love anyway, but...
Absolutely, yeah. And the fact that it's, you know, that we could still love it after so many years of doing the same thing, it's like, you know, we're meant to do it to an extent, or, you know, I don't know. I know I could be doing music for the rest of my life easily, and it would still make me happy. Even if I'm super broke because of it, I'll still do it. Try again, it's easy to say. When your body isn't broken and your feet aren't chained. When your mama thinks things will be okay, but they're bending your brain. Things changed, and I just want to control all this rage. There was a moment in time when I swore to my mom that I'd rip cops' face off. I put a bomb in the middle of a federal courthouse with the name of Trayvon. With the glue your eyelids to your forehead and tape your mouth shut, you can't say much. So I'm just gonna keep waiting when I'm up. Oh, my. It's a better thing, better than we can ever do with this whole lifetime. I don't wanna make another one for a cup that never grows, wide. Don't make it because you don't work out fine. I can never find the time to design a time machine to rewind. I can never run a light, those bright lights. I'm the ever gonna do with blind eyes. Only really wanna redefine my life with a sense of the timeline. When I die, I will explode into the night.
like who are some like your favorite writers or philosophers? Like what kind of writings and philosophy inspire your shit?
Oh wow.
Or songwriters, or like what are some like serious inspirations for you?
Wow, so many different. One of my favorite songwriters ever is this guy Silvio Rodriguez. He's a Cuban Nueva Trova singer-songwriter, folk singer, and he was definitely a product of the Cuban Revolution, and he was sort of put up on a pedestal as the voice of the revolution to an extent, but he was actually very critical of the revolution at the same time, while showing an amount of respect for that history of what those guys did. He's just an amazing poet as well. So if you do understand Spanish well, I would really suggest checking out Silvio. One of my favorite songwriters ever, huge influence on me with when it comes to writing and music. This guy, Oscar Zeta Acosta, he wrote two books. He wrote a book called Autobiography of a Brown Buffalo and Revolt of the Cockroach People that definitely changed my life when I read those books. He had this sort of beat style of like, you know, casual writing, but and maybe influenced by Hunter S. Thompson or something to an extent as well. But it was, I could relate to it more than any of those guys. Just being a fat Latino guy that was interested in radical politics, and this guy ran for sheriff of LA under an anarchist platform. Yes. You know what I mean? He was a lawyer, but he was a poet, and he was, you know what I mean? This dude, he disappeared at sea in the late 70s. But
oh, nice. That's perfect for you.
His books really influenced me a lot. Obviously, Chomsky, reading like Chomsky in high school, and you know, Marx, man, just even stuff like when it comes to fiction writing, like Borges, stuff like my parents were interested in, Martí. My parents, you know, they studied, you know, do their Latin American studies professors and literature professors, Spanish, Latin American literature. So that influenced me a lot as well. Film, all that stuff, man. Richard Wright, man. Richard Wright. I recently was thinking about how I even got interested in radical politics. I think reading Native Son as a freshman in high school was a big part of that. I mean, all his books are sort of stories about Black youth in the 1920s and 30s, all the way through the 50s. But some of it's really autobiographical. There's a book called Black Boy about him growing up in the South. And yeah, I mean, but he joined the Communist Party. And there's a book called The Outsider, which I read in high school, after reading Native Son and being influenced by that. And it's about being a Black man in the Communist Party in Chicago. You know, the title says a lot. You know, his own critiques of those of the party, and you know, the workings of it, and feeling alienated, and it sort of radicalized me in a way as well. You know, he has these ideals of, you know, firmly believes in equality and all these things, and firmly believes in Marxism. But he also talks about the relationships within this party, feeling alienated by them, not feeling necessarily welcome always. That was really interesting to me, because it was like, all right, sometimes we have to take our hits to make this happen, you know what I mean? Like, sometimes we have to work with each other. You know, it's about, like, to me, what it was about was, like, working with each other for a common goal, even if we can't always see eye to eye. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, like, race stuff is certainly really complex. Like, right now with what's happening in Denver, the conversations around privilege and race and class, it's like a rapid moment of education for the country right now, because, you know, white people are learning about their privilege in, like, this racist system. Some are denying it. You know, how do you feel about the conversation about race right now, and kind of, like, you know, what do you think people should be thinking about with what's happening in the country?
I think it's incredibly important, and this time is just incredibly important. It's true. It is an education period, and I think that's why I've been quicker to be involved with local protests and stuff like that out here in New Haven, because I've been seeing our community – specifically our black community out here, which is, you know, I would say it's close to the majority of this city is an African-American city, black city. So it's nice to see that community get involved in something like this, like and intermingle with college students and white radicals and people like that. It's really important right now to even have these discussions, like making people think about it at all, having these, you know, shutting down a freeway or shutting down a major road is forcing meditation to an extent. It's forcing people to think about, why are these people doing that? Why are we even having this going on right now? What's going on with race in this country? What's going on with the police in this country? A lot of white people in this country become defensive when talking about race. You know what I mean? There's no way around that. They haven't been educated when it comes to these ideas of white privilege or whatever. So now they're getting that lesson. I think that you put it really well when you just said they're getting like a crash course in white privilege, you know. But when it comes to your fans or hip hop fans, that shocked me to an extent. I honestly thought that your fans would understand this better than most. The fact that people are on my Twitter and your Twitter denying racism exists, white people denying racism exists, denying that these police cases had anything to do with race, that shit is just, it's just mind-boggling to me. I just don't understand. But I think I'd like to believe that for every person like that, there are 10 others that are actually learning that this shit does exist, and this is the terminology or whatever, you know what I mean? I'd like to believe that.
Well, I don't know. So I've just been like thinking about white supremacy, you know, yes, and trying to make people think about white supremacy and what it means, you know, like, can you have a black president, a black police chief, and a black mayor and the city still runs on white supremacy? Like,
absolutely. Yes. It's about teaching people about the roots of white supremacy and how they're still ingrained in the system. You know what I mean? I think a lot of people just, because of things like, you know, having a black president, we seem to forget that slave owners started this country, you know?
Right.
That the basic laws of this country were founded by racist white men. And I think that's a really important part of this conversation as well. I've been seeing libertarians mainly, people like that, like they might be against the cops or something like that, but then they'll defend the Constitution to the death. And if I'm criticizing, you know, a Constitution written by racists, then they're fucking ready to criticize me and they become defensive. And it's wild to me that people can't look back in history and look at look at things in a bigger context. It's just, but that's what this is about. That's what these conversations are about. We're not going to bring those lives back that were taken by police, but we can, you know, educate the community more, our communities more. And I don't know.
Yeah.
Just, yeah. It's, force people to think about it.
Yeah.
Force,
I mean,
force thinking.
It's crazy though, man, but I got to say it's really inspiring, man. I mean, we've had protests in Denver every day. I mean, the cops have become fucking parade marshals, you know?
Right.
It's
fucking, have you noticed in Denver a different cops kind of taking on different techniques this time around? Are they kind of standing back a little more? Are they trying to get, do they seem nicer to you?
Oh yeah, this time, man. Around? I mean, this is, I'm positive that a federal memo went out, right around Ferguson saying, come de-escalate every situation. Do not make any arrests, no matter what. And that's why people have been pushing their luck, you know? And it seems like the gloves started to come off this weekend with, the Millions March out of nowhere. People are getting trumped up felonies. Like, we have someone in our, who is literally just waving a flag. Six cops bum rushed him, arrested him, and charged him with assault, second degree assault, claiming victims' rights in the case, and he's in jail for $50,000 bond. And he didn't do anything. I mean, there's a slow motion video of his arrest, and it's like he's completely innocent, and the cops know it. And I think they did it in Chicago. They did it in Oakland.
Berkeley went wild.
Yeah, and I feel like they do that so that, like, all of us, you know, radicals who do jail support will, like, spin our wheels trying to fucking hold bake sales for the next 6 months to try to get the motherfucker out. Yeah, I mean, there's so many layers to what they're doing, and they run multi-levels of psychological warfare. I mean, I just was reading this thing, or Time was telling me about these Scott Crow files that were leaked, about how, like, one of the FBI's way of getting information about who the players are and stuff on activists is by trolling Facebook pages. And then they see, like, who responds, what do they say. It feels a lot like Occupy, like, the confusion and neurosis that I see going on. It reminds me a lot of Occupy, but it's on a bigger scale. I mean, what these protests have accomplished is something tangible, and it's something important, man.
It's got to be more frightening to them as well. I mean, bringing race issues into it so directly, bringing police issues into it so directly, you know, it has to be more frightening to police and the government in general. I think it has to be than Occupy was.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's because, I mean, look at history. I mean, if you look at Greece, or every once in a while, like, this is just a perfect storm, and then boom, you know. And that's the thing that gets me about these white motherfuckers. Like, hey, why aren't you fucking tweeting about this handicapped girl? Why aren't you tweeting about this white guy who was shot by the cops? And it's like, it's like,
you're criticizing the entire system that created the police violence. I see that with you. You even, I mean, and I've done the same things on my social media, whatever. I try not to focus too much on race, and try to really criticize the system. You know, I'll call it a racist system, but if it's going to make people defensive and not listen to what I'm saying, I'm going to try not to, you know, to get people to listen more than anything. To, I don't know. It's confusing to me.
Yeah, no, that's, but as a white dude, I feel like it's my role to always, like, remind these white motherfuckers, like, this race shit is real.
On a basic level, though, we can all, if a bunch of us agree on the fact that these murders are unjust, that's a great step forward. That can open up many conversations and lead to those conversations about privilege, about systemic racism, you know. Let's just all agree that the shit is unjust right now, for now, and then teach from there.
What can you say about your next album? Like, what are you singing about? What are you talking about?
Oh yeah, sure. I can say that this album represents me probably better than anything I've done in the past. It's, you know, a lot of my stuff is like autobiographical or whatever, but this one sort of represents my views on the world a lot better as well. It's the first song on the album was actually done in 2007. And then, you know, the last song I recorded was done maybe a couple months ago. So it spans a good part of my life. It represents the last, especially the years. It represents the years before I went to prison, and then a little bit of it represents after, you know, this past year when I've been out. And I don't know, I just feel like beyond anything I've ever done, it represents me now better than anything.
Yeah, so. I mean, the writing on the new stuff is just so fucking dope, man. I mean, all the new songs are just like so real and human, and it's pretty political, actually.
That's the way Factor put it too. He was just like, it's just very human, you know? Like, I don't even, that's the way he put it. I'd like to agree with that. And yeah, it is political, and it has some of my most blatantly political songs as well. Like, I have a song that's basically, it's like a minute and a half of grievances. Just like, it's, I don't know.
Any love songs? Any breakup songs? You got some?
No,
none.
No love songs or breakup songs on this. But you know, but they're all love songs in the way that Crass said. You know, like that's how I like to think of it. They're love songs to, you know, they're made out of love. There's love songs to dead people and love songs to my mother and love songs to, I don't know, people who want a better world. And some of it is just kind of depressing as well.
Well, good, man. I mean, you're, you know, checking off all the boxes. Oh, you know what? This just popped in my head. How long have you been a vegetarian?
14 years. 15 years, maybe.
Why are you a vegetarian?
Oh, I went to Cuba when I was 18, and with my mother. My mother is involved in like Santeria and stuff like that, and so I saw some animal sacrifices. I remember being in this little room that was about 6 feet square, and having all these like goat heads and pig heads at my feet and just dead animals. And I remember just struggling to eat meat on that trip. And when people would offer me chicken, even, or I remember eating shrimp with, you know, the eyes were still connected. We had to like clean it ourselves. And even that, I just couldn't confront my food. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I feel like it wasn't right of me to eat meat because I can't confront my food. I can't eat animals. And then, you know, that's just stuck with me. That was the initial reason for sure.
Yeah. The only reason I ask is just cause like, I realize like I know so many vegetarians and so many vegans, and kind of like after the late 90s where like vegans were really kind of militant, and you know, you were more likely to be made defensive by a vegan than have someone bring you over to their side. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so I think a lot of people like me and you, like, we don't really talk about animal rights, you know? And
yeah.
And like no one really, and like the vegan food scene isn't really about animal rights. And after I went to that resistance ecology conference in Portland, I just started really thinking like, man, why so many vegans are so comfortable, or vegetarians are so comfortable with like the meat processing plant right down the street where, you know, 100,000 fucking cows are killed every year. And You know what I'm saying? It's fucking crazy, man.
I mean, I'm definitely not comfortable with it, but yeah, I'm not spending my time protesting it either. You're right.
I mean, I'm not either. I mean, that's the fucked up thing is that, like, there's not a lot of that shit happening outside of the Pacific Northwest, sadly.
It's true. It's a real disgusting product of capitalism, you know? It's like it's another feature of it that it's like the luxury of eating mass-produced, you know, this meat that's been packaged and we can't even see its face or know where it comes from. I don't know. It's just – it really is this luxury of capitalism that people don't really think about very much. But yeah, as a kid, I would definitely see, you know, in the mid-90s especially, I was part of a music scene, I'm coming back to this again, where it was common to be straight edge and vegan. And so even though I wasn't vegan, I was straight edge for quite a long time, but I remember them constantly doing actions on meat processing facilities and stuff like that, freeing animals from testing facilities, you know?
Yeah.
That was like a big thing in the mid-90s.
Yeah, and then 9/11 just kicked the shit out of everything that was happening, all the organizing.
Yeah, absolutely.
They got most of the post 9/11 anti-terrorism stuff was going after the ELF and the ALF. So
Right.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, like, so much has happened in our lives and things are happening so quick that it's so easy to kind of forget how we got to where we are. I forget about 9/11 sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, I do too, and but I'm constantly aware of what 9/11 has caused and why we're in the place we are. A lot of it is because of 9/11 laws that were, you know, formed after 9/11, and, you know, the way the government goes after domestic terrorists and everything. Yeah, you know, that's all because of 9/11. It's crazy to think about.
Well, what are we gonna do, man? What are we gonna do? I guess stock up grains and ammo and, you know, get an InfoWars subscription and we'll be okay. Oh, shit.
I got played on a anarcho primitivist podcast recently. Isn't that crazy?
That's not crazy. I mean, you're I don't know. You have more. I was like, if you said anarcho capitalist, I would have said that's crazy.
That's crazy. Yeah. No, that would be crazy. No, it's funny. I actually brought you up. I met these people and through our friends in the DIY Bandits, and I brought you up because you left a John Zerzan book in my car. And I read it because of you. And that's the only reason I even knew about the whole Eugene, Oregon, like, movement. And, yeah, it was,
I like that book.
Yeah. I don't know if I ever give that back to you, actually.
No, I was wondering what happened to it. It doesn't belong to me, actually. It belongs to the scribe who let me borrow it in, like, 98 when he was trying to explain to me anarchism.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah, you remember the scribe? Fuck the GOP.
Oh, I know all about the scribe. I bought his book, actually.
Fuck yes.
About underground hip-hop.
I don't know. To me, like, I like reading about anarcho-primitivism and stuff. I think there's so many valid things there. I just, you know, it's hard to debate a lot of that stuff, so.
Yeah, their ideas on his, you know, about history in the historical context of, you know, capitalism, the birth of capitalism, that's really intriguing to me. Agriculture and stuff like that, you know? That's stuff I've talked to Pepe from the Bandits a lot about.
And I think if you look at what Zerzan is saying now, or what a lot of to me, like, the primitivist movement is way more nuanced than I think it was in that Zerzan book, you know? I don't know. Like,
absolutely. Like, and I think they're, you know, I mean, the fact that there's a primitivist podcast shows that.
Right. It's not a primitivist scroll being pigeon carrier.
Yeah, they're building some pretty interesting communities out in Germany and stuff. It's pretty, which I'm sure it's going to happen out here too.
Like what?
Just like moving in the woods and you know, surviving in outside of society, outside of civilization. Huh. To an extent, you know. As much as we can. And so it's like me, I just got off parole this past week, and it's like, yeah, people are like, oh, congrats on the freedom, and I'm just like, yeah, it's freedom to an extent. It's a step towards freedom. I don't know what freedom actually is or how we'll ever achieve that, but
well, if you can feel free for an instant, did you go out and drink on the night of your parole?
No, I did not.
Wow. So that's a kind of freedom in itself. You didn't feel the need to express that inner alcoholic, you know?
Absolutely not. Yeah, and I actually ended up seeing my parole officer at a Thai restaurant that afternoon, like, nice. Later on. And he introduced me to his fiance. And I was just lucky, man. The guy that was my parole officer, he's so cool and so interested in my music and stuff like that. He was like, he's like a social worker, you know. He wanted me to get out in the world and actually do all right and succeed and survive. And I almost teared up telling his fiance that. I was like, your fiance is a good man, you know. And I saw it in his eyes too, you know. He's like, "Damn, thanks for saying that."
Wait, is he a cop?
He's not a cop. Okay. No.
Okay. Good. I was gonna have to fucking delete this whole podcast, man.
Oh, believe me, man. If there's anyone that hates cops, it's you, and maybe me.
No, I don't hate anyone, man. I just, you know, whatever.
No, I definitely.
Your parole officer was on some NWO shit, wasn't he?
He was.
That's awesome.
And he would try to pick apart my lyrics and talk to me about conspiracies and stuff like that. It was interesting. He's like, hey, before you go today, what was your take on the JFK assassination?
That's awesome.
Such a cool guy, though. I was very lucky to have Officer Watts.
You have learned a lot. You're about music and music industry and how to have a career and, like, you know, it's in these fucking crazy shitty times. What advice do you have for young artists or musicians that are trying to, like, you know, in their bedroom and they're looking to do music professionally? Other than don't.
Yeah, they're just starting out right now. I would say the most important thing to sustain a career is to have a community around it, to have a following that will follow you for the rest of your life, as long as you make music, like Soul has. And to get that nowadays, it's going to take, obviously, having internet presence, proper social media and all that crap. And I feel like performing and getting out and playing shows is a really important part of that. I think that's how I built. I definitely didn't build my fan base with social media. I built mine with playing shows and touring my ass off and opening for, you know, more established artists and stuff like that. I think that's a big part of it. I think a lot of people overlook, especially in hip hop, a lot of younger artists overlook playing shows, I notice, at all, which is wild. I mean, they just try to go the route of killing it on their social media and promoting their shit through Twitter and stuff like that. And I think it's really important to meet people because that forms bonds and allegiances. You just don't get necessarily just on Twitter, Facebook and stuff.
Right.
So make good music first and then try to develop, play shows with that good music. Put on shows in your town. I think that helps a lot of people. Bring, you know, save up a couple bucks and pay the guarantee for a more established artist that's and put on an awesome show so that artist remembers. Maybe one day you'll be opening for that artist. You know, things like that. I don't know. A lot of artists nowadays, they assume just because they make great music, and I think a lot of, you know, everybody who makes music thinks their music's pretty good or else they wouldn't put it out in public. So they think they could just make great music, put it out online, and they deserve to have a career because of that. That's just not how it works. You have to follow through and play the shows and meet people and get out there more.
Right. Yeah, I mean, anybody I know that's doing well right now, that's how they did it. I mean, the other, because the thing is, the internet shit is so fleeting. Like, yeah, it's important, but it's so fleeting and it's corporate owned and fuck, man. Fuck.
And when it's all gone, when it's all just rubble and all the computers are gone, we're still going to have fan bases of people who support us because we know them in real life. And I don't know. You're right, though, about the fleeting, the trends, and I don't know. That doesn't seem sustainable.
Yeah, I'm just like, I just know I spend too much time in front of social media, and like I try so hard to not, and I don't know if it's addiction or like what it is, but like I'm just like distracted all the time, and
yeah.
So I have to keep like, and I don't know if it's because I'm smoking a lot of hash oil or what, but like I'm always like, I'm just so distracted. Like I'll sit down to like work on something and then like I'll remember something and then I'll do this. And then next thing you know, I've just like clicked on 5 YouTube videos from people I hate. And I'm just like, what the fuck am I doing right now? Like
we're addicted to information. We really are. And I noticed that the first day I went to prison, I noticed that I was craving information more than ever before. I noticed that I needed to read something. I needed a simple conversation wouldn't help. Laying in my bed thinking wouldn't help. I needed somebody to feed me information. It's crazy. When you shut yourself off from that, you really notice it. I remember reading Christian pamphlets because it was all I had to read. It was, you know, I remember I read 6 John Grisham books. We're addicted to it as a culture, you know? Crazy.
Yeah, it's fucked up. John Grisham books. Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, shit, dude, all those letters, that was essentially a Twitter feed, I guess, you know, for you.
Yeah, some of the letters were sort of like Twitter feeds. Like, this is the gossip going on.
Oh, man. Oh, shit.
Which I actually appreciated a lot at the time, you know?
I mean, if you were smart, what you would have done is, like, glued them all together, all the letters together on, like, a giant scroll, and just kind of, like, cranked it circularly so, like, the letters would just, like, go up and down like a Twitter feed. Any last words, man?
Yes, I'd like to thank you, and because you're a huge reason why I do this music stuff. Still, and it's crazy being 33 years old and thinking back to being 19 or 18 or whatever, whenever I met you and saw you doing this stuff. And it's awesome to see you still killing it out there. I just want to thank you for inviting me on here, and thanks for inspiring me.
Well, right back at you, Chesky. You know I got nothing but love and respect for you, and I owe you my life, dude. I owe you my life, man.
I will never make a dance song, but you could dance to anything, even the silence that my words bring. Dropping like the apocalypse is burning our city down, because the apocalypse is happening right now. We don't need no fucking love songs, but you can call them what you want. You could say every song I sing's a love song, like crass thought. You could argue that every one of my songs means fuck the cops, it probably does. But these words were actually written by all of us. And as I belt this bloody prose from the bottom of my guts, I can feel the stomach as I'm swimming up to the top of my throat. And I think that I know that this bitter taste is the fact it's my last, but I hope I'm so broke, broken. With the smoke from burnt buildings choking me, totally corroding my innards so slowly. Woe is me. Will I fall to the bottom of the ocean, buried in moss? Or will I rise up to the high heavenly top, only to jump off? Even if I wanted to be cream of the crop, this work will be tossed and lost with books and dreams and the heat of flames. Underneath the rubble of a final devastating holocaust, nobody's boss and no one's mine. But the day I die, any motherfucker that I wanna come and try, come find me. I'ma keep this pride, my sleeves are rolled up, working every minute for the fake fourth of it. I'm showing up, but I told y'all that I've been affiliated with some motherfuckers that can make it really glow up. These lips are sewn shut, we're watching statues crumble down as our heroes lose. The kids just wanna fucking drink more booze, not hear bad news. No one ever make a dance song for the funeral. That is, unless you think that this is one. All I wanna write's a song to sing.